today on Flashpoints. Revolutionary ecologist, environmental warrior Derek Jensen joins us for the full hour, and we'll welcome listener calls. What are your thoughts on what needs to happen to rescue the environment from warriors and corporate polluters and real destroyers of our world? I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoint. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I know that you've been hearing a bunch from Derek Jensen. He was the key organizer at a very important conference, Earth at Risk, that took place recently here in Berkeley, California. And he is really on the cutting edge, the radical edge of ecologists, earth savers. People are battling the corporate will to save this planet. And it's a real throwdown now. Derek Jensen is, in fact, an acclaimed author of 20 books, including A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, and Endgame. His writing has been described as breaking and mending the reader's heart. That's from Publishers Weekly. He holds a degree in creative writing from Eastern Washington University, a degree in mineral engineering physics from the Colorado School of Mines, and has taught at Eastern Washington University and Pelican Bay State Prison. Well, those are two interesting and different institutions. And he has been speaking on the university circuit. He's been speaking all over this country at libraries. And we're delighted to have you with us live, Derek Jensen. Welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, last we spoke, it was only very minimal. We were essentially promoting the Earth at Risk conference. But I wanted to invite you back. You know, this is that week in the year when we really do consider where we've been and try and spend a little time on the air reflecting on the key issues and what really needs to happen now. You really are, I say on the cutting edge, I should say on the uncutting edge, because you want to stop the cutting and the destruction and the tearing down. You really are rather outspoken about it. You wrote for your introduction at the Earth at Risk conference. Earth at Risk is a conference about fighting back. The dominant culture civilization is killing the planet, and it is long past time that those of us who care about life on Earth begin to take the actions necessary to stop this culture from destroying every living being. Well, I really have invited you on now to take it to that place. You talk about actions, taking actions to stop the end of the planet. Before we get into that, and I think that perhaps people might be troubled by some of the things you and other people are suggesting in terms of what needs to happen to restrain the warriors and the destroyers, but let's just do, if you will, with me, a quick assessment. Where are we in the planet, in planet Earth? How bad is it? What do you see the telling tales of the end of the world as we know it, unless we do something radical?
Well, 200 species went extinct today, and 200 species go extinct tomorrow and the day after, and the day after that. And, you know, this is a year in review, so if we want to talk about some of the things that have happened in this past year, what's 365 times 200? Let's see, what's that?
I got a pen in front 70, of me.
70,000? Is that right?
More. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Those are species who are never coming back. And just this year, I learned that, in fact, like a few weeks ago, I learned that there has been reproductive failure in oysters in the Pacific Northwest the last few years. And of course, every article that I saw about it talked about what a drag this is for oyster farmers, because now they have to raise their babies inside and then put them out in the oyster beds. And there was no mention of wild oysters in any of this. You know, pretty much every biological indicator, there are no biological indicators going the right direction. Topsoil is being lost. I already mentioned species extinction. Rates of toxics in the environment are going up. Rates of carbon emissions are going up. And so I don't, you know, in terms of the real world, you know, I live in far, far northern California in Crescent City. I've lived here for 12 years now. And I was doing sort of the other day, I was figuring out what has happened in the 12 years that I've been here. And I live in some second growth forest that's, you know, protected and locally, you know, extremely locally, the right things are being done, like, you know, on this particular set of acres. But in the last 12 years, newt populations have collapsed, butterfly populations have collapsed, banana slug populations are collapsing. It used to be that when I would walk through the forest at night during the right times of year, I couldn't avoid stepping on banana slugs. And now, you know, if I walk a quarter mile, I'll see five at the right time of year. So there's still banana slugs, but nothing like it was before. Banana slugs, for crying out loud. Daddy long legs populations are collapsing here. And moth populations, used to be a fair number of moths 12 years ago. Pacific tree frog populations, it used to be that starting in about another 3 weeks to a month, you couldn't hold a human conversation outside at night because the frogs are so loud. And now there's just sporadic. Red-legged frog populations are collapsing. Giant salamander populations, I used to see them once in a while, and now I see them almost never. You know, we can just go on and on. This is just where I live. And anybody who's paying attention anywhere, you know, is seeing these sorts of collapses. It's going, oh, hummingbirds. You know, it used to be my mom puts out hummingbird feeders. And at the right times of year, she would have to put out, oh, gosh, she had five on her porch, and she'd have to replace them two or three times a day. And now she puts out, like, two and leaves them out for several days. Almost no hummingbirds. You know, once again, no matter what you're looking at, it's not good. And in terms of the response by those in power, I mean, for crying out loud, they're trying to dismantle the EPA. And the global warming denial is in full sway. And this is true just about anything. Just a second. Can you put them away, please?
Well, there's some life. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacific Radio. Not a problem. Go on.
Anyway, so, or we can also look at this. They did a study a year or so ago, and it was of, they tested the compassion of college students by, you know, giving them a survey. And would you do, you know, under these circumstances, would you do this? Would you do that? Would you, you know, how would you feel about this person who had something happen? And just in the last 20 years, you know, once again, you know, sort of quantitative social analysis, which we can take, you know, for what it's worth. But in the last 20 years, there's been a collapse of compassion among college students by 40%, you know, in terms of would you care if this other person did this? And that's not good. Or we can also talk about the single greatest commercial use of the Internet is pornography. You know, it's like, and I'm saying those things in terms of not only is the world collapsing, but, you know, just this week I got a note from somebody who was saying, oh, you know, what we're going to have a great spiritual transformation. And there are people who rely on that, and that's not going to happen. You know, I don't want to put the fate of the planet, I don't want to gamble the fate of the planet on something that's about as likely to happen as for unicorns to start, you know, spewing pixie dust and jumping over the moon. So it's like a doctor friend of mine says, the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And like a lot of indigenous friends say, the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds, to look at the situation the way it is. And then one last thing here, and then I'll shut up, is that one of the ways I look at this a lot is if space aliens had come down from outer space and they were systematically vacuuming the oceans, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. If they were vacuuming the oceans, if they were putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk, if they were changing the climate, and they were, you know, there's 2 million dams in the United States. There are 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall and 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. And if we only took out one of those dams every day, the 70,000 dams, it would take 200 years. And salmon don't have that time, and sturgeon don't have that time. So anyway, the point is that if there were space aliens who were doing all this, we would know what to do. But suddenly, because it's this culture, then we all of a sudden get really silly, and we start thinking that somehow if we compost, things are going to be okay, or if we take a shorter shower, things are going to be okay, or if there's just this great magical transformation that we all know is not going to happen. I mean, that's not how social change takes place. That's never how it's taken place. So by hoping for the perpetrators to have a change of heart, it's not what happens. So, you know, the first thing I think we need to do is look at our situation, just like you asked, and then start asking, okay, so what are solutions?
Well, we saw a recent conference in South Africa. We hear things like, and I want you to sort of untangle this, because these are the phrases floating around for most of us. Kyoto was a waste of time because everybody didn't participate. We have some good new ideas, but people have to be patient. We have things like carbon trading to restrain the corporations. You want to talk about these commonly announced solutions for a situation that's well beyond the possibility of using these kinds of things to solve them?
Yeah, sure. Well, first off, there's... when people talk about wanting to do something to stop global warming, they're not really asking how can we stop global warming. If you ask a reasonably intelligent 7-year-old how do you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, I'll give you an answer, which is stop burning oil and gas. And if you ask a reasonably intelligent 35-year-old who works for a green high-tech consulting firm how you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, I'll give you an answer that actually doesn't help the planet, but instead helps the green high-tech consulting firm. And another way to say all this is that what do all the so-called solutions to global warming that are commonly presented have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And that is literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because without a planet, you don't have a social system. It's the planet that must be the independent variable, and our social system that must be dependent upon the planet, because we are dependent upon the planet. And so, once again, when people ask, how can we stop global warming, what they're really asking is, how can we stop global warming without stopping the burning of oil and gas? And the answer is, you can't. And so I think that, once again, if they were space aliens who were changing the climate by burning oil and gas, what we would do is we would dismantle the infrastructure that allows these perpetrators to do this. And then back to the carbon trading thing. If we presume, I mean, one of the reasons that all these people can suggest all these solutions that actually don't do anything is because their primary identity, they primarily identify with industrial civilization and not with the planet itself. And what I mean by that is a lot of these people, a lot of the people who are working on these issues will say that explicitly that they're attempting to save civilization. But it's civilization that's been killing the planet for the last 10,000 years. I mean, the first written myth of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq. And the forests of Iraq were so thick, they were cedar forests that were so thick that sunlight never touched the ground. And they were deforested to make cities. And then later on, it was called the Fertile Crescent, and nobody in their right mind would call it that now. The Near East was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. The three of the big Greek dead guys, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, all complained that deforestation was harming water quality. And I would bet you that the ancient Greek Department of Environmental Quality, or its equivalent, said, well, we need to study this for a few years to make sure that there's a correlation, which is still what's happening today. And so the point is that this, I mean, the reliance in Greece, this culture is based on destroying land bases. And one of the problems, there's two problems with it, well, many problems with this, but two of the primary problems with destroying your land base is that one is that once you've embarked on that plan, then you need to keep conquering, because if you have overshot your carrying capacity and you've harmed your own land base, in order to survive, you need to keep expanding. It's not just capitalism, and it's not just, you know, debt capitalism that causes this expansion. This culture has been expanding. And for crying out loud, there was somebody wrote a book quite a while ago and said that people were supposed to go forth and multiply, and that book became a really big bestseller. And one of the reasons that that imperative is here is because you have to have a growth economy. Once you've committed to a growth economy and you've destroyed your own land base, you have to keep expanding or you will collapse. And the other thing that's really bad news about this is that if you are willing to destroy your own land base, then that gives you a competitive advantage short term over other cultures, because you can turn the land base into war. Into war materials. The forests of North Africa were cut down to make the Phoenician and Egyptian navies, which helped them to conquer other people. And, you know, those old ships of war, you know, in the sort of great age of sail, I don't remember what the numbers were. I think it was 800 old growth trees would go into building each one of those. It was some huge number, 80 maybe, I don't know, it was a lot. And obviously, if you have that sort of technology, you can conquer other people. But of course, it's a dead end, because where you can't continue to have infinite growth on a finite planet. And so back to the original point is, there's this great guy, Peter Montague. He's done such great work forever, and he's retired now, but he used to do Rachel's newsletter on toxic, which is great. But for one example of what I'm talking about, with people care more about civilization than they do the planet, is that even he, he's so smart, but even he would say that carbon sequestration, where you pump it underground, was a really bad idea, because if it all escaped at once, quote, it could end civilizations we know it. It's like, no, Peter, actually it could end life on Earth. And so that's another part of the problem. This culture is so supremely narcissistic that to say that you care about sharks or polar bears is immediately to be put into a position of, what, you don't like humans? It's like, well, no, that's not the point. The point is that I actually have compassion for these others, and I care about these others. And, you know, I don't know if you've noticed this, but almost every time that there's any article about some endangered species, it has to talk about the economic impacts of it. It doesn't talk about the being for its own sake. It's all utilitarian, which is an extraordinarily narcissistic perspective. That's another part of the problem, and that's not going to stop. And I guess I want to say one more thing about this. I want to take in, you know, I do a lot of my work also about domestic violence and abuse of women and abuse of women. And there's this really good book called Why Does He Do That? Inside the Minds of Angry and Controlling Men by Lundy Bancroft. And in that book, he talks about how it is that perpetrators of abuse so often don't stop on their own. They don't. There's a very high rate of recidivism for it. And what he says is that perpetrators of abuse often gain tangible benefits from perpetrating their abuse. And they can become essentially addicted to power and addicted to the tangible benefits that they get from perpetrating this abuse. And one of the problems is that addicts, you know, the cliche is that addicts don't change till they hit bottom. But one of the problems is that if you are addicted to power over others, you're not the one who hits bottom. Everybody else does. And so that's one of the things that's happening right now is, you know, sharks are screaming and oceans are screaming. And, you know, stolid scientists are saying that coral reefs, who've been here for, what, 60 million years or longer, I don't know how long they've been, a long time, that they could be gone within 30, 40, 50 years. And I just wrote an essay, I just finished it the other day, about how You know, there are many ways that we don't live in a democracy, and we absolutely don't live in a democracy, and everybody knows this. You know, does the government take better care of corporations or human beings? And, you know, it's a stupid question. Everybody laughs. Of course, everybody knows it takes better care of corporations. This is not a democracy, but there's another level at which it kind of is, because if you look at what people actually care about in their day-to-day lives, you know, honestly, more people care about the results of football games than they do. It's like one of the jokes I tell that's not very funny is that there's more people care about the Louisiana State University Tiger football team than care about real Tigers. And same is true for Miami Marlins versus real Marlins and on and on. It's very, very quickly. There was a great example of participatory democracy in action here in Del Norte County a few years ago where the supervisors wanted to reduce the number of marijuana plants that medical marijuana users could have from 99 down to 6. And the Board of Supervisors meeting that night was packed with people who would not allow them to reduce it from 99 to 6. They reduced it to something else, I don't know what. But the point is, for one night, there was that's how participatory democracy is supposed to work, where people care so much that you don't allow the so-called representatives to do something that's against your interests. That's the good news, that for one night there was actually participatory democracy. The bad news is that I wish that people cared about the salmon as much as they care about marijuana, because they don't come out for the salmon. They don't come out for the snowy plover. They don't come out for things that are more important. And they did come out for that. And anyway,
Let me again tell people we're speaking with Derek Jensen. We're going to open up the phones in a little bit. You can call us at 510-848-4425 in a few minutes. 510-848-4425. Frank, what's the 800 number? So it's 1-800-958-9008. If you want to use 800, 1-800-958-9008, 510-848-4425. You know, I saw a film the other day called If a Tree Falls. It was an investigation into the group, the Earth Liberation Front, and the ELF had taken to burning down buildings that were, and destroying buildings that were engaged in this kind of vicious policy. One of the examples that the film showed was how the government had decided to round up these wild horses off the plains. They decided somehow that would be a good idea for I'm not exactly sure what. But what the film showed is a slaughter of these beautiful wild horses. Horses in the most vicious way. Now, of course, you could understand how people could be provoked by this kind of action to go after, to figure out a way to step beyond, you know, holding a peace sign up in front of a nuclear power plant. However, I mean, you know, in recent years, we've seen Rwanda and Burundi. You know, we've seen, we could start at Vietnam and just all the slaughters forward. We just saw Iraq, a war that we were lied into. I'd hate to think about, does anybody know what the atmosphere over Iraq looks like after 30 years of war? You know what I'm saying? It is so deep. Now, you're not talking about resisting with a picket sign, are you?
Actually, I sometimes get pegged as the violence guy, and I don't really like that because I really am the everything guy. That I think that signs, picketing with signs, is a fine idea if it works, and if it doesn't work, then I think you should move to Plan B.
What's that?
Well, it would depend on the circumstances. I think that let's take the Klamath River for example. That the dams, there have been deals made that the dams are going to come out, and it's not soon enough, and I wish it were sooner, but in that case, the process is kind of working a little bit. It may. So I think in that circumstance, that was an appropriate thing. I think that in other circumstances, that other tactics are more appropriate, and One of the examples that I look to is the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, MEND, and that's indigenous peoples in the Niger Delta, which once was the largest wetlands in Africa, and now is pretty much the largest sludge lands. It's been absolutely trashed by Shell and other oil companies. And it's a really great example of, you know, we've all heard of Ken Saro-Wiwa, who was murdered by the Nigerian military at the behest of Shell, Shell Oil. And they were a purely nonviolent, he was part of a purely nonviolent group that was attempting to stop the destruction of their land. And as a result, I think eight or nine were murdered, executed by the military, by the government. And the next generation uses different tactics. At this point, they use sabotage and kidnapping, and they have been able to reduce oil output in the Niger Delta by 30%. And there was one strike alone, I believe last December, a year ago, that they reduced it by 10% in one strike. And there have been times when they've reduced it by up to 80% for a while. And that is a tactic that is appropriate in their circumstances. And then, I mean, what I'm really all about is I'm all about putting all the tactics on the table and discussing them. That doesn't mean we have to take them. We can certainly reject them. But another tactic, which I want to say, before I even say this, I want to say this is not what I'm suggesting in the United States for any number of reasons. But one man, all by himself, almost stopped World War II. And that was George Elser. Who? George Elser was a trade unionist who didn't like what Hitler was doing to the trade unions. And so he set out to assassinate Hitler. And in 1939, he had a bomb set, and it was all set for when Hitler was going to give a speech. But because the weather changed, Hitler changed the time of his speech, and the bomb went off 20 minutes too late. It's 1939. Everybody who talks about resistance in World War II recognizes that with Hitler dead in 1939, there is no World War II. And once again, I want to be really clear. I'm not suggesting, I mean, especially given all the right-wing rhetoric about killing Obama, I want to be really clear, I'm not suggesting assassination in the United States. What I'm suggesting is that in that circumstance, that was an absolutely appropriate tactic. And right now, the world is being killed. And if we don't do anything, the world is dead. I mean, there may be bacteria somewhere or something, but that's an insane argument to say, well, the world can't be killed. When people say that to me, it's like, well, you know, you talk about killing the planet, but it can't really be killed. I say, great, you got a knife? And then somebody knows I have a knife. I say, great. So I hand me the knife. I get the knife, and then I open it up, and then I go over to the person who said that the planet's not going to be killed. It's going to be changed. I say, okay, can I have your hand? And they give me their hand with trepidation, and then I don't actually cut off their fingers or anything, but I make like I'm going to cut off their finger. I say, okay, I'm not going to kill you. I'm just going to cut off this finger. I'm going to cut off this finger. I'm going to cut off that finger. And then I'm going to cut off your arm. I'm going to cut off your arm. And you're not going to be dead. And in fact, after that, I'll cut your throat, and you won't be dead because, of course, there's still bacteria inside of you, and they're alive. And, of course, they don't do any of this, but my point is, and people get the point, is that it's to say the world can't be killed is to show no compassion whatsoever for the massive, the victims of this culture. And that's really the point. You know, the hard part for all of us is to switch our identity, to not no longer identify with this culture, but instead to identify with the land base and with the living beings of the earth. Once you switch that, everything becomes technical. And I'm just saying this. You said a little while ago, we got into a war. And it's like, that's one of the ways, and don't worry, I say this to my mom all the time, it's pretty funny. And my mom will say, oh, it's so terrible that we torture and everything. It's like, oh my God, Mom, you torture? It's like, look, I'm too old for this. Don't do this to me. And I got a friend who called me up and said, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Afghanistan? And I look around, I was like, we're in Afghanistan? I thought we're in North California. My friend's like, okay, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Afghanistan? I said, I got troops? Holy crap, will they do what I tell them? I'm like, yeah, this is why I only call you once every 6 weeks, and she hangs up. But the point is that one of the first things I think we need to do is to break that identity and to identify, you know, if you really want for the Delta smelt to survive, what do you need to do? If you really want for salmon to survive, what do you need to do? And that's, and this, it's not just non-humans also. I mean, if you want for indigenous humans to survive, What do you do? I mean, right now, I mean, the genocide is ongoing. I mean, they're planning, the IMF and the World Bank are planning a whole bunch of new dams on the Mekong River, which are going to wipe out the world's large catfish, going to wipe out lots of people. It's like, I got a friend who used to be married to somebody from Bangladesh. And even 15 years ago, his mother could say to him, go to the river and catch us a fish for lunch. And he could do it. But now the river's so polluted that they can no longer get fish from the river. They're no longer food self-sufficient. And this is happening all over.
All right, let me just interrupt, not to be defensive, because I love language. And I'm very interested in the pronouns and the way we address people. And I, on this program, we don't talk about people as being inmates, because really what they are is prisoners. And I love the linguistics, but to be clear, when we talk about this, I have to ask you, do you drive a car? Do you pay taxes? Then you do.
Oh, that's crap.
You personally.
That's total crap.
So what happens when you go to the gas tank? How much tax and where does it go?
See, that's the thing, is one of the big cons that's been put on us over the last 25 years, really, is that there's this notion that because you participate in the system that you are culpable. But indigenous people, traditional indigenous people, never say this. And one of the reasons is because they don't identify with the system. Here's the most important thing I'm going to say all evening, which is the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to dismantle those systems of oppressive authority. And, you know, I've written entire essays about this. Like, I have one called Forget Shorter Showers, which is, oh, my God, you know, the world's running out of water, so you need to take shorter showers. Well, if you do the math, it ends up that about 90% of water is used by agriculture and industry. And of the water that's used by municipal human beings, that's the same as is used by municipal golf courses. So I'm not really interested in personal purity at all. I don't care about personal purity. What I care about is dismantling the systems. Years and years ago, I was like probably 20 years ago, I was saying to this indigenous friend of mine, I feel so bad because I drive a car and I'm responsible for global warming. And she said, look, you didn't create car culture. Don't take responsibility for it. You are culpable. Yeah, sure. You know, you got your little percentage, but really, if you care about being carbon zero, then, you know, go ahead and either kill yourself or better, you can actually stop the system. That's our responsibility. Our culpability is not because I use toilet paper. My culpability is because I don't stop Weyerhaeuser and Boise Cascade. That's a much, much more serious challenge. I mean, think about this in terms of a resistance movement. You know, does it really matter? I mean, the German resistance against Hitler, they used for one attempt, they used hand grenades that they got military members themselves. They used hand grenades from the military. Do you think that the Vietnamese really cared whether the guns that they got, that they used, were made in the United States? That's not the point. The point is stopping these larger institutions of power.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Derek Jensen, and we're talking about the future of the world. Really, that's what we're talking about in terms of the physical, the structural. Will we have a place to live and exist in? Will this place we live in be lost, and things are moving very quickly. Derek Jensen is on the front line of this. We want to invite you, 510-848-4425 or 1-800-958-9008. It is a very sobering subject. And all right, Derek, we're going to bring our first listener guest into this. Who is ever out there? You're on the air with Derek Jensen. Harry, that's you. Go for it.
You're in San Francisco. I find people to be very apathetic. And the park is being privatized and sold off to the wealthiest people. Coca-Cola recently gave a grant to Golden Gate Park. And on the day before Occupy San Francisco was ejected, the Board of Supervisors voted 11-0 to name a meadow in San Francisco where numerous tree concerts, say by people like Chet Helms, had happened for a billionaire. And so I was wondering, you know, what specific steps, what things do you have just to motivate people? Because as you say, and I think a lot of in the first place, just having government responsive means having people that are active and interested and willing to take on authority about the type of things you mentioned. So what have you found to be the best techniques for motivating people?
Okay. Got it, listener.
Well, thanks for that great question. And what I've found is that I try to find what people love. When I sign my books Endgame, I sign them, Find What You Love and Defend Your Beloved. And you must love something. And that's one of the great things about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. It's like I have a friend who used to run the Battered Women's Program for the state of New York. And, you know, she didn't really care about salmon. And we don't talk about salmon. But we talk about violence against women because that's where her energy lies. And, or there's a, you know, if I were to talk to the local computer store owner who's being driven out of business by Walmart, you know, I don't talk about Sam with him either. We talk about the effects of big box stores. And there have been times, you know, when I do talks at universities, sometimes the teachers will force students to come to the talk. And it's always kind of a drag because they never want to be there. And, you know, if everybody's there voluntarily, then we just talk about whatever we want. It's all fun and great and everything's great. But if students have been forced to come, a lot of times I can just see the eyes glazing over. Nobody cares. And what I've done sometimes then is I've switched what I'm talking about from talking about the environment to talking about the wage economy and how crazy it is that 90% of the people spend, you know, don't like their jobs. And the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do. And I talk about that. And one of the reasons I do that is because, it's like an environmentalist friend of mine says, a lot of environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground. They end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. Because when you start asking, why is this piece of ground being destroyed, then you start asking why ground is destroyed at all. And then you start asking about why is it that you have a way of life that destroys land bases? And you keep going back and back. And the same can happen. Like there, you said that they were going to name this park after a billionaire. That's a great place to start. Why do we valorize billionaires? And then it's like that starts that questioning. And so one of the things I do is I just try to find the wedges where people are already upset at the fact we don't live in a democracy, at the fact that Occupy San Francisco was shut down, at the fact they're going to privatize Golden Gate Park. If that's what you, did I hear you correctly? That's what they're doing?
Essentially, the caller is gone, but essentially that's it. And just to be clear, they're going to privatize everything, the whole push around the university system and the state CSU system is about the move for privatization. I mean, it's all going in that one direction.
And that's a great rallying point. And then the other thing, I'll shut up on this. The other thing, I think that's one thing I think is really important, is to find the places where people are already either they already love something or they already hate something that's happening. That, you know, find the places where there's the passion. And then the other part is to find what people's gifts are. There's this question I just love, which is, what are the largest, most pressing problems you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? I'm a really good writer for the books I write, but, like, I do terrible press releases. Like, I can't do it to save my life. And I'm terrible at organizing. I'm incredibly messy. And, you know, there are gifts I have and there are gifts I don't have. And then also, you know, I love the question of, if you put it a little bit crudely, but not anything we can't say on the radio, it's like, what do you get off on? You know, I get off on writing. I love writing. And there are other things, once again, press releases, or, you know, I've done timber sale appeals before, and I wasn't very good at it, and I didn't like doing it. But I know people who are great at it, and they totally get off on it. Well, there's a great attorney down in the Bay Area, Sharon Dugan. I just love her. She's so great. She's done such great work, and she does legal work. She's argued before the state Supreme Court. She's done all sorts of great stuff protecting forests. And I could never do her work, and I would hate doing her work. But she's got a gift for it. So, you know, what do you get off on doing, and what are your gifts? And then just asking those questions, and then bam, people are ready to be plugged in. And then you also, one more thing, which is you need a supportive community. You need other people who will encourage you to keep doing the work. You can't, it's so hard. We can't fight the culture and our friends too. So you got to be able to find friends who will, who will support you in the work, will help you in the work, and will go with you to do the work.
You know, Derek Jensen's talking to us. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're taking calls. We're going to get to another caller soon. But, you know, I think about Derek Jensen, this carpenter and sort of hand craftsman who fled the Nazis in Italy, Antonio Porcia, to end up with the Nazis in Argentina. And he used to sort of spout these incredible phrases. I think he was translated by W.S. Merwin. And one of the things that he said is, truth has few friends, and those few are suicides. Now, bear with me. Gandhi told the truth, they shot him. King tells the truth, they shot him. Judy Berry tells the truth, they blow her up. So there is an extraordinary violence that represses truth tellers at the grassroots level, if you will. So it's a very dangerous world in which to take a radical action, and there isn't an equality of protection, if you will. So, you know, I really need to push you, because, I mean, for instance, I have friends as we speak now, they're in Moscow, Idaho. They're trying to stop these massive trucks that are transporting the various pieces for the tar sands coming in from south of them and going up north to Canada. And these trucks take over the entire road. You get stuck behind a truck, you're in an ambulance, you die there. And what happens when these incredibly brave, and there are many of them there in Moscow, Idaho, to stand up? They get beaten, arrested, dragged around, maced, and pushed out of the way. And these massive road-destroying, environmental-destructive movements of this kind of material continues. So, like, what is the radical action you're suggesting that stops something like this? Forgive me, but really, you know, again, we're back to the protest sign, and we know it's not going to be about, you know, credits and carbon trading and all that. And that's all we're talking about, though, right?
I think I am not going to make a specific suggestion for your friends or anything, because I don't know them, and I'm sure that they're doing really.
They're the friends
work.
Of the all the friends of the earth down there, whether they're fighting it down there in Moscow, Idaho, or whether you're Judy Berry being blown up after you take this kind of radical action, or whether you're the ELF people who are going to spend large chunks of their life in solitary confinement because they went over the edge, never killed anybody, never hurt anybody, but had enough. And so what did they do? I'm not advocating this. You're not advocating this. But what did they do? They took an action beyond holding a picket sign, because every time they stood up with a picket sign, they got their asses handed to them.
And that's, you know, we could make a long, long list of people, you know, Sophie Scholl, Tecumseh, you know, we could John Brown, you know, we could go all through. This is what the state does, and this is why we fight them. And I think that what we need to do is we need to start thinking like warriors ourselves. And one of my CDs is called Now This War Has Two Sides. And war has been declared against the planet for a long, long time. And we need to start recognizing that this is a war, and we need to start fighting back. I mean, so many of the Black Panthers, they're still in prison, you know? They're in prison. My mom writes birthday and holiday cards to them, and they've been in prison for 40 years, some of them, and many consider themselves prisoners of war, and we need to start thinking like a serious resistance movement. I once asked Darja Mail, he does great work, and Darja Mail is a great example of somebody. He just knew that things were messed up in Iraq, and that he knew that the corporate press coverage was terrible. And instead of just complaining about it, which is what I do, which is what a lot of us do all the time, he just said, okay, I'm going to do a better job. And he went over and did a better job of reporting from Iraq. And I asked him one time, if it wasn't heavily guarded, how long would a bridge last in Iraq? He said, less than 24 hours. And I want to go back to what I said about space aliens. If they were space aliens who were moving these trucks, how would we stop them? I think World War II was won by the Allies for two reasons. One is because the Russian military, you know, lost 20 million people and killed, I don't know how many Germans, but destroyed the army. And the other is because the Allied bombing campaigns destroyed the German military, the German industrial capacity to wage war. And almost always, I mean, the American Civil War is an example. Wars are not usually won on a battlefield. Wars are won by affecting industrial capacity. And this is what we need to do is we need to study asymmetric warfare, because that's what this is. And those in power hold all the cards, really. But that doesn't alter the fact that there have been asymmetric warfare campaigns that have won. The African National Congress stopped apartheid. They didn't stop capitalism, unfortunately, but they did stop apartheid. The Irish were able to, after 800 years, push the British out of most of Ireland.
All right. Listen, I'm going to jump in here because I do want to get some calls on.
Great.
We've got, we'll see if we can move it pretty quickly. Armando, you're on with Derek Jensen. Armando, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. Yeah, sorry we took so long to get to you. Please ask your question.
Yeah, beautiful discussion. My question is around the idea of rethinking resistance and protest, and going from this paradigm of, or while simultaneously enacting dismantling processes, also enacting restorative processes. I just wonder, my question is around what you see as like an immediate cultural shift in protest to have a regenerative and restorative function.
I think that the I think restoration is really important, and I know a lot of people who are doing a lot of physical restoration work, rehabilitating riparian areas, and I think that that's absolutely crucial work. And I think that there's also some really important work being done at the level of localization, relocalizing food. You know, CSAs, I belong to a CSA, and I think that those efforts are really important. And and we were talking a moment ago about the Irish struggle against the British, and even members of the IRA, not just the Irish population itself, but even members of the IRA, only 2% ever picked up weapons. 98% is doing either support work, or also one of the things that they did that was really crucial is they set up their own court systems. And the U.S., I hate to valorize the United States people in 1776 and 1770 and 1780, but one of the things they also did was at the same time they were gearing up for militant resistance, they were setting up their own court systems, and they were setting up alternative economic systems. And I think that those are really crucial parts, and I would say 98% of any resistance movement consists of that sort of logistical support and of doing various attempts at restoring, both physically restoring and also restoring a sense of community identity. I think that's all crucial work. It's like the logicians say, I think it's necessary but not sufficient.
All right, Patrick, you're on with Derek Jensen.
Uh-huh.
Yep, Patrick.
I just got a question. I was reading your book, and I agree with about everything in it, but your long-range solution of getting rid of civilization, I don't know really what that means, but anyway, going back to a Stone Age hunter-gatherer society, that seems like an insane thing to do after getting rid of capitalism, and that'll just wipe out all the animals left, you know, for food, you know, with millions of people. That's insane.
Okay. All right, caller. I think we got the drift. Derek Jensen.
I think we need to start with what is physically possible. There has only ever been one way of living that is sustainable, and that is essentially Stone Age technology. The Talua lived where I live now for 12,500 years, at least. That's if you believe the myths of science. If you believe the myths of Talua, lived just in the beginning of time. In any case, it was a really long time. And they did so sustainably. And there are actually quite a few. I just learned the other day that 10,000 people would gather every year for their world renewal ceremonies. They would come all the way from what's now Humboldt Bay and all the way up from what's now Gold Beach, Oregon. 10,000 people, that's quite a few for this area. Anyway, they lived here sustainably, and we will once again be living at that level of technology, and the only question is really what's left of the world when we get there. And so every cell in my body wants for us to have this voluntary transformation where we just throttle down and, you know, we use, instead of the military getting bazillions of dollars, that the money goes for schools and for health care, and we slowly throttle down. I just don't see it happening. Once again, every cell in my body wants it. I don't see it happening.
All right. Well, Chris, you're on with Derek Jensen.
Yes, Derek, you're one of the few writers, even in the alternative media, talking about the elephant in the room, and I put you in that category with Lier Keith, who is talking about the population elephant in the room. And I was interested, you had said that her book saved your life. Was that from a dietary standpoint, or is that from the standpoint that she is talking about the complete unsustainability of systems as we're pursuing them?
Remind us who we're talking about, too, Derek Jensen.
That was the book saved my life for health reasons, really, because it I have Crohn's disease and I struggle with that pretty constantly, and the arguments in there convinced me to go off wheat, and that has. I still have Crohn's, but that helped immeasurably. That was a couple, 3 years ago. And so far as the bigger picture, I think that would be a case of parallel evolution. It's kind of like sometimes people ask me if Daniel Quinn influenced me. And the truth is, and there's nothing against Quinn at all, I didn't read Quinn until I'd already developed my own ideas. Had I read Quinn when I was in college or something, oh my gosh, it would have helped me so much. And it was the same with this, that it would have helped me a lot had I read it a lot earlier. But it was pretty parallel. One of the ways that she's really helped has to do with she's helped hone a lot of my pro feminist positions.
All right, we've got Leif on with Derek Jensen. Leif.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I heard Joanna Macy about 10 years ago. And I agree with what she said. We need to not only curb what we do individually and take care of ourselves, but we need to dig in our heels and do what Eric's talking about. So I have a suggestion. I've got a cabin I built on a utility trailer, and it's got windows and a blacktop. It's 85 degrees in there right now with no heat. And other thing I'd like to say is, I really think that we need warm clothes and waterproof clothes, and we need to know how to be more mobile. And the most thing I really want people to consider, okay, so you can't stop everything. You don't feel you can stop driving your car. How about just drive at 25% this year? How about if you fly back east to see your parents? How about do that once this year instead of twice?
Does this, all right, thank you, caller. Yes. Does this mean anything, Derek Jensen, to you? Is this the way one restrains the end of the climate and the environment as we know it, saves it?
I think once again we can take those personal actions, but I think that the most important actions we can do are to attempt to direct or indirect confrontations with power and to dismantle those systems. So go ahead.
You're gonna Daniel, we're going to get one more caller in here. Daniel, you're on the air. Is this Daniel, yes?
Yeah, I am here.
Okay.
I couldn't hear you, Dennis. Yeah. Actually, Derek, I think your whole philosophy just propagates the problem. You just talked about the fact that this is a war, and now it has two sides. This is not a solution. The solution is to recognize what it is that causes those who are in power to want to stay in power, and that is they want status, they want money, they want their way. The only way that has ever worked in history is to say to power, not to confront them, whether it's Raytheon, say to them, okay, look, what were your total triple net profits over the last 10 years? Take the standard mean average, and we will pay you not to build the
all
predators.
Right. I think we have about 2 minutes
for Derek
respond. Thank you.
I think if you can pay Raytheon to, if you have the money to pay Raytheon to not build stuff, then I wish you best with that. But that's not, and it's just not accurate to say that it's never actually worked to confront power head on. I think World War II is a great example, and it was state against state. Vietnam is a great example of a colonized people taking on a colonial power. Slavery was stopped not by buying out slaves, but instead through massive dislocation. And I think that the first thing that we need to do is to recognize that power concedes nothing without demand. And demand doesn't mean buying them off. And demand also doesn't mean begging, because if you make a demand but you have no way to enforce it, that's begging. And so the question is, how do you marshal power in some form or another? See, here's the thing is that those in power only understand force, which doesn't mean violence, by the way. This is part of Gene Sharp's wonderful work. You know, if you've got, you know, a million people on the streets, that is a form of power. And one of the best environmental presidents of the last 50 years was Richard Nixon, in part because he was so afraid. Well, he was afraid of Watergate, for one thing. He's also afraid of the massive protests about the war, and he wanted to distract people. And
so he invented the EPA and supported the Arts Council. Other things happened as well. We're out of time, Derek Jensen. If people want to follow, what's the best way to follow what you're up to?
They can go to my website, derekjensen.org. And they can see, you know, some of my essays and stuff. And also they can go to deepgreenresistance.org.
And there is plenty there to understand and grow from. We thank you for joining us. We're out of time. I'm Dennis Bernstein. That's Derek Jensen. Check him out. He's got a lot you might want to look into. That does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints.
Wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer, as well as producer of Flashpoints Español, is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Frank Sterling. Friday co-hosts include Francisco Herrera, Evelyn Sanchez, and Renee Sacedo. We get technical assistance from Falcon Molina and production assistance from Carla West. And our intern is Alyssa Buckman. To listen to archives, go to flashpoints.net. Thanks for listening.
Poetry, music, fiction, visual arts, film, Radio 2050, the collision of Latino politics and art in Northern California. Radio 2050, the anticipated year when the majority turns, la gente moving together toward tomorrow's majority. Join host Paul S. Flores and the Aztec Parrot on Saturday night, 6:30 to 7, on Free Speech Radio, KPFA 94.1, Berkeley.
Dame la fe, sin tu voz el destino parece rendirse como ves. Dame la A,
And you are tuned in to KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. Stay tuned now.